shall not, we shall not be moved. We shall not, we shall not be moved like a tree that's planted by the water. We shall not be moved.
The Southern Documentary Project was the brainchild of Matt Herron, a budding photojournalist who had moved with his family to Mississippi in 1963 to work in civil rights and shoot pictures for Life, Look, and the Saturday Evening Post. He's just put together a new book called Mississippi Eyes, which chronicles the events and the powerful witness of five young photographers in the Southern Documentary Project working during the pivotal summer of 1964 in the segregated South. Together, they captured the sometimes violent, sometimes miraculous process of social change as segregation resisted, then gave way to a new beginning toward social justice. Again, the title of the book is Mississippi Eyes, the Story and Photography of the Southern Documentary Project, and we welcome Matt Herron to the roundtable this morning.
Hi, Joe. I'm delighted to be here.
It's very nice to have you with us. This is a beautiful book. It's a beautiful project. Before we talk about the book specifically, at what point did you realize that this was going to become such a central part of what you would do in your life?
Probably after the fact, but during that period, I always knew I was photographing history. And I took many photographs that I might not have taken had I just been following an assignment, because I thought I was chronicling history and I wanted to do it as thoroughly as I could. So I guess I partly knew it was important, but I didn't realize it would become the center work of my life.
You started the Southern Documentary Project. What were the rules? What did you want to originally accomplish?
I had had some pivotal meetings with Dorothea Lange, the well-known documentary photographer from the Dust Bowl 30s and 40s. Dorothea convinced me that this medium could be my way of expressing my feelings about social justice and things of that nature. So in the spring of 1964, as the civil rights leaders were getting ready to bring 1,000 college students into the state, I asked myself, what can I do? And it seemed like a good moment to get a documentary photography team together and try to focus not only on the events of the summer, the demonstrations, the freedom schools, the voter registration efforts, but also the manner of life that black people lived in the South. So I went to New York and I recruited photographers and raised some money with great difficulty, then got started. Dorothea agreed to be my advisor. And it turned out that this was the first time a team of documentary photographers had entered the field since the 1930s and 40s, the Dust Bowl documentation. So that's what I tried to do.
You address this in the book, but that recruiting of photographers, you were specifically looking for photographers with some civil rights experience.
Yeah, I convinced Danny Lyon, who had decided he'd given up on civil rights, to come back and join us for a summer. There was a young photographer from Ohio that I enticed to come south. Dorothea recommended George Ballas, who was running a labor newspaper in Fresno, California, and starting to photograph the work in the fields of Cesar Chavez and other migrant labor activists. And then late in the summer, a young guy came down from New York who was unknown to the powers that be in Mississippi, and I saw an opportunity to do something I hadn't been able to do before, which was to go into a white community and document the way of life there. So that constituted the five of us, and we worked very diligently for a summer, not always in close contact, but pretty much in contact with the work. And at the end of the summer, I'd hoped that the project could continue as a university-sponsored documentary project. But times were tough, and it was hard to raise money, and I finally had to settle for our summer's work.
The shoestring budget that you were working on is quite incredible of what you were able to accomplish with little or no money.
Well, we paid ourselves at the rate that the SNCC staff paid themselves, which was under $25 a week. Mm. And we added to that cars and film and supplies and so on. But $10,000 in 1964 was actually kind of real money. It was the minimum I thought I could raise, and I was totally unsuccessful at raising it. I'm not a very good fundraiser. And toward the beginning of the summer, I walked into the office of Howard Chapnick, the director of Black Star Photo Agency, and poured out my troubles to him. Howard got on the phone and he raised the $10,000 in about 20 minutes. I was dumbfounded. Life gave us half of it as a guarantee that we would be there if something they wanted to photograph came up. And Black Star put up some, and I think a labor union or two donated the rest. So it wasn't much money, but we made it work.
Meanwhile, the actual work, you had violent confrontations, simply trying to chronicle what was going on.
Oh, sure. I mean, so did the civil rights workers. We were all faced with threats, more often threats than actual violence, but you never knew when something was going to happen. One of my photographers, David Prince, very early in the summer, went into Selma, Alabama with a life assignment and was subsequently beaten and nearly killed by Sheriff Jim Clark's posse. Was driven out of town, went to a hospital in Montgomery, and I followed him in the next day to take over the work. It was pretty frightening, and we lived partly by our wits and partly by a set of rules that you could call street smarts that I operated by and that most of us learned to operate by.
The name of the book is Mississippi Eyes. Your geographical location, though, varied, right, throughout the project?
Well, I set up headquarters in a small black farming community in the Mississippi Delta, a place called Milestone. I really needed to be at a place where I had access to a telephone and could direct the rest of the guys. And although I did move around, that was kind of my basis. But the others moved more or less constantly. George Bellis worked out of his car in southeast Mississippi, mostly. Danny Lyon ranged all over the state. Dave Prince was up in the Ruleville, Mound Bayou area, and Nick Lawrence was with us only for about 10 days, so he stayed in Ruleville. But we did move around, and not only in Mississippi, in Alabama and Georgia, and the photographs represent other states as well as Mississippi.
Matt Herron is our guest. The name of the book is Mississippi Eyes, the Story and Photography of the Southern Documentary Project. I think it's interesting, you alluded to this a moment ago, but you then couldn't keep the project going because of a lack of funding, and even the book project was difficult when you sent it to publishers. Do you have a sense of what it was then and what it is now, of why that is an issue?
Well, today, civil rights is considered a historical moment. Everybody celebrates the fact that we were there and did stuff, but at the time, feelings were very mixed about civil rights. I had promoted the project to a dean at Harvard. I had contacts at the Annenberg School of Communication and the University of Miami, where one of the life editors had gone to teach, and the U.S. Information Service. And Boston University was interested in the book, but one by one, these things fell through. It was hard to do it at that time. That's all I can say. Then I took a whole suitcase of photographs, fortunately no original negatives, to Mexico with me with the idea of editing the book. And one night in what I thought was a safe middle-class neighborhood, the car was broken into. And I'm sure the thieves thought that heavy suitcase was going to be very valuable, and they probably threw it down a ravine when they discovered it was only photographs. But I lost a complete set of prints and quite a lot of contact sheets. And it took a while for all that to be gathered together. And then my agency, Black Star, lost the material for 25 years. And only when somebody opened an unused filing cabinet did they discover my work was still present and had been lost in the mail. So there were a lot of delays. And finally I decided, well, this is kind of an important little piece of history. And if I don't write it, nobody else will. And the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer is coming up. So I set out to put the book together.
I think it is interesting that even to sell the photography at the time, that there didn't seem to be an understanding that you were shooting history. And why that is surprising is when you look at the images and you see the people and you see the emotion and you see the numbers of people that are included, that you very much realize that something very, very big is going on.
It took the country a while to wake up. The strategy of the civil rights leadership was that if we make the issue strong enough, and you have to understand that the plight of black people in the South had been successfully ignored by the whole country for more than 100 years. So this was not a new phenomenon. I remember going to an executive at Kodak trying to get 1,000 rolls of film for the project. And Rochester had just gone through civil rights disturbances. And he was adamant that we should do nothing of the kind. So we faced a lot of that. And the other thing is that while the pictures show large numbers of people, and indeed there were a lot of people who came south during the summer of 1964 and later joined the Selma March the following year, the actual numbers of people who came into the South and worked weren't that large. I can't give you figures on the SNCC personnel, but it couldn't have been more than 100 or so, maybe 150 people. And they merged with local leadership in small rural towns across Mississippi and Alabama. And these folks had been working for years trying to and get some rights for black people. And so it was that critical combination of young, mostly black kids coming south from universities in the north and various places. Stokely Carmichael came from Jamaica to some northern college and then to Mississippi. But it was that kind of crucible of these young militant kids and the established, older, local civil rights leaders working under great stress and privation and sometimes working quite quietly focused the whole movement together and caused it to erupt. None of us were certain that we would have any success at all. We just knew that we had to be there doing what we were doing.
The name again of the book we're talking about, Mississippi Eyes, the story and photography of the Southern Documentary Project. Matt Herron is our guest who founded that project. We spoke a moment ago of the violence that you encountered, but of the subjects of the photography, the men and the women who were the civil rights workers, the men and women who you were photographing, how did you respond to them? What was your relationship with them?
It was the most extraordinary moment in my life, or period in my life, particularly during 1963, before there was much attention focused on Mississippi. Those of us who were there felt like we were on the front lines. Probably our experience was somewhat akin to what soldiers go through in Vietnam or places like that. We bonded together, and it was the only time in my life when myself as a white person felt like I had really joined a completely integrated, beloved community in which the color of my skin didn't matter at all. It was a brief period, but it was a an almost spiritual period in some ways for us. And that got under our skin. So black people in small rural communities took us into their homes, fed us, often protected us, and we're very grateful that they were getting help and that we could work together on this this big undertaking. So I think the people who came south and worked in the civil rights movement were totally changed by it, and their lives were never the same since. I have one photograph of a totally unknown summer volunteer taking a bath under a pump in a Freedom House in near Milestone. And that guy's name was Mario Savio. He went back to the University of California at Berkeley and started the free speech movement the next fall, which spread to virtually every college campus in the U.S. So Mississippi spawned. It was, in some ways, it was the birthplace of the modern women's rights movement. It certainly contributed to, in many ways, the anti-Vietnam War protests and a lot of social radical activity that erupted around the country following that summer and those times.
Realizing this may be a difficult question to answer and to put into words, but did you learn, along with everything else, did you learn of what the power of a photograph could be, of what story and what powerful, incredible story a simple photograph could tell?
Oh, sure. As I said earlier, I knew I was photographing history. Charlie Moore's photographs of the police dogs in Birmingham had already been passed around by members of Congress and were influential in moving them toward passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1964. I acted as a witness, and I knew that my job was not to be a hero, not to get arrested, not to get beaten, not to lose my film, but to get through a situation and get out of it any way I could and get to an airport and get the film on a plane. That's the way we worked. There's a photograph, it's not in the book, but there's a picture I took the following summer of a young guy being knocked down the steps of the federal courthouse in Jackson and then put into a paddy wagon by the Jackson police, who have him have a stranglehold around his neck. And he's holding up a sign saying, I forget, I think it's Stop Police Brutality. Who's the witness to him? I'm the only one. I'm the photographer there, but he knows that I am his only chance to get that moment and that picture and that expression out into the world. Some people say, yeah, we didn't know that we were part of history, but I certainly did. I often would take a magazine assignment and use it as a cover for taking a whole bunch of other photographs that really didn't relate to what my assignment was. And I'd submit the pictures, and the pictures that the editors wanted would get used, but the rest would go into files, and they would get used later, or they would appear in this book, or, you know, all kinds of things would happen to them.
There is a picture on the cover of the book of a young black boy, and he is looking up to the camera. Do you look at that picture and say, whatever happened to?
I do. I want to go back and find that kid. I went back to that country church where I photographed him years later. I learned his name, but I've never been able to locate him. The strange thing is that intense, penetrating stare that he has, which just stopped me in my tracks at the time and caused me to photograph him, I encountered that kid a year later. When I was going through a poor black neighborhood in Canton, Mississippi, I had forgotten the original picture. I had no memory of the kid, but that same look stopped me cold, and I spent probably 20 minutes just taking pictures of him. And later I realized, wow, you know, that's the same kid I photographed the year before. Mm. The title of the book, Mississippi Eyes, has another dimension to it. As I wrote in the back of the book, Those of us who trained our eyes and our cameras on Mississippi had our eyes trained in turn by Mississippi. Our encounters with Mississippi taught us to look at this special place with eyes that were skeptical and questioning. What was said to us, what was seen by us, was not always truthful or actual. And when we left this place, we carried our newly trained eyes with us. From that time onward, we looked at the world through Mississippi eyes. That title came to me in the fall of 1963 when I was awakened from bed by the news that the president had been assassinated in Dallas. And I threw my cameras into a bag and got on a plane and flew to Dallas. And I was part of the incredible press clutch in the Dallas police station. And everybody was, you know, doing what they could. But I noticed that I was looking at the statements by the Dallas police with a much more jaundiced eye than most of my colleagues. And that evening, I asked myself, what's going on? Why am I not so quick to believe what they tell us? And it came to me that I was looking at Dallas with Mississippi eyes, that I had been trained to be skeptical by my previous experience in Mississippi. So that's where the title of the book emerged from.
Well, the title of the book is Mississippi Eyes, The Story and Photography of the Southern Documentary Project. The book is published by University Press of Mississippi. If you want to see the picture that we were talking about and the book jacket, it is on our website. It's wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. Again, the book is Mississippi Eyes, The Story and Photography of the Southern Documentary Project, founded by Matt Herron. Matt, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your stories. I so appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you, Joe. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Again, the title of the book, Mississippi Eyes, published by the University Press of Mississippi. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.